Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. First, in a few minutes, we'll be joined in the studio by Forrest Hilton, who is an author of a couple of books on Latin America, published by Verso. He will be here to discuss the reaction in Latin America to Obama's election and what Obama's policies towards Latin America might look like. Some surprisingly good news there if everything works out as Forrest sees it. So keep our fingers crossed on that one, and we will hear more about that in several minutes. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by Kate Gordon, who is the Associate Director of the Apollo Alliance, which is an entity that is promoting green jobs. For those of you who've been listening for the last couple of months, know that that is something very much on my mind right now. The combined agenda of saving the earth and generating some form of just and sustainable economic growth at the same time. Kate Gordon will tell us all about that, what she and her colleagues at the Apollo Alliance are up to, and what we might expect from the new administration on that particular front as well. Before we get to all that, some comments on the news. Further signs of economic weakening piled up over the last week, and not just in the U.S. Some 15 countries have reported declines in GDP in recent quarters, among them big ones like the U.S., Japan, Germany, the U.K., Spain, Ireland, Italy, and France, and less big ones like Singapore and Latvia. And since that doesn't add up to 15, there's some several others as well. More of all this is likely to come, and the weakness will spread probably to the so-called developing world in earnest over the next several months. China is a long way from joining the negative growth crowd, but its industrial production index declined between September and October, and its yearly growth rate in industrial production has declined from close to 20% a year ago to 8% now. While most countries would envy an 8% growth rate, even back in the fat days of the 1950s and 1960s, growth in U.S. industrial production averaged only around 5%. For China, such a dramatic slowdown harbors great risks. Slower growth could expose the rot hiding in Chinese banks. 10% growth can make a lot of bad loans look not so bad. But they start looking kind of bad when growth drops towards 5 or even lower. And also, slower growth could heighten political tensions in a country where mass protests have become routine and where it would take all the fingers on scores of millions of hands to count the unemployed. On Friday the 7th, we learned that the U.S. lost 250,000 jobs in October, bringing the total loss since last December's peak to 1.2 million. Losses in the early part of the year were mild by historical recession standards, but we've managed to get back up to those historical standards with the accelerated deterioration we've seen since the summer. The unemployment rate rose a sharp 0.4 of a point in October to 6.5%, the highest since 1993. On Thursday morning, we learned that first-time claims for unemployment insurance, as I always say, a very timely and sensitive indicator of the state of the job market, rose a strong 32,000 last week to 516,000. Now, these week-to-week numbers can be very volatile, so we have to see if this is sustained. But if it is, this rise brings the measure very close to the levels it reached in the 2001 recession, though it's still well below the heights seen in the deep recessions of the mid-1970s and early 1980s. I am expecting, though, that this recession will come to rival its more savage ancestors in the coming months. Ditto the unemployment rate, which is almost certain to approach 8% over the next several months and could move towards 10% if the economy continues to deteriorate, as is suggested by the leading indicators. On Wednesday, Treasury Secretary Henry Hank Paulson announced that he was completely abandoning his original strategy for the $700 billion financial bailout, that is, buying up bad assets, mainly toxic mortgage securities from banks. He's now going to be moving instead towards direct capital injections. As I've been saying for weeks, based on the experience of other countries, such direct capital injections have proven to be a far more effective strategy for resolving a financial crisis than Paulson's original plan. The initial reviews from the financial markets were bad as interest rates rose on short-term lending between banks, ending a three-week decline, and the stock market took a steep dive, which was reversed on Thursday. Who knows what Friday will bring? Reviews from Congress were far more positive, but I wouldn't take the reactions of either the markets or Congress very seriously, at least for now. Why the about-face by Paulson? Market pundits said it made him look uncertain and confused, and policymaking look like a pure seat-of-the-pants operation. It could be that Obama and company told him to hang back because they want to run the bailout by their own lights. If equity injections are the wave of the future for the bailout program, then let's hope that the new gang doesn't follow Paulson's lead and make it non-voting stock. If the government is going to rescue this gang, it must do so on harsh terms and with a gun held to their heads. No dividends, no bonuses, no hoarding of cash. Arguments were made in that direction yesterday by a rare joint statement by the senior federal bank regulators, that is the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, and the Comptroller of the Currency, who urged banks to cut back on bonuses, cut back on dividends, and start lending money again. Now let's see if they really mean this, if they put any teeth in that, or it was just a fine, high-minded statement. I've certainly been plenty critical of Barack Obama over the last several months, but it does look like his posse is thinking straight on these sorts of financial bailout issues. We can see hints of that in his proposals for an auto industry bailout that they've also been floating in recent days, strings tightly attached to make sure that recipients use the cash to make clean, energy-efficient cars. Obama's designated chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, generally a market-loving, hyper-Zionist creep, did say something interesting in the last weekend. He said, "Never allow a crisis to go to waste. There are opportunities to do big things." While that might sound like something Naomi Klein could use in the paperback edition of The Shock Doctrine, it may not be the way she meant it. The context in which Emanuel said this was that the auto industry crisis, and it seems like he meant to force Detroit to invent some cars that won't wreck the climate. That would be a great use of the auto industry's crisis. More on all this at the bottom of the hour when we talk green jobs. But is this really what change looks like? Barack Obama has selected Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, who said that 500,000 Iraqi children killed by sanctions was a price worth paying, not that she was paying it. He selected Albright to be one of his emissaries to this weekend's economic summit. The other emissary is former Republican Congressman Jim Leach, rather a sane person by the standards of his party, but still not the sort of guy you'd confuse with a new broom. Add to that familiar names like Rahm Emanuel, John Podesta, Larry Summers, Tom Daschle, and John Kerry, and, well, just how changiness is this change? On Wednesday, Obama's transition team published a list of people who will be guiding the transition process over the next several weeks. As Laura Meckler and Jonathan Weissman put it in the Wall Street Journal, quote, "The group is filled with second-tier veterans of the Clinton administration and workers in the technology and financial sectors. It includes four former lobbyists, three top campaign fundraisers, and two former employees of troubled mortgage giant Fannie Mae, with some overlap among them. Four people in the group have ties to the consulting firm McKinsey & Company, and two have experience leading high-tech startups." ABC's Jack Tapper adds, 16 of the 19 of these folks worked in some capacity for the administration of President Clinton. Changiness, it's everywhere. As is some sort of depression consciousness. The cover of the next issue of Time magazine will have Barack Hussein Obama as Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And the Gourmet Garage, a small chain of moderately upscale food stores in New York, is calling its sale items New Deals, and the signs advertising those decorated with a caricature profile of FDR with his famous cigarette holder. The official NBER certified bottom in the 1929-33 contraction was March 1933, the month that FDR was inaugurated. I wonder if that cyclical magic will transfer to Obama come January 20th, 2009. Okay, let's take a musical break and we'll be back with Forrest Hilton.
As he pulls my pendulum, he feels these attention, these feelings frozen over.
And that's some of Wire's Maroon from long, long ago, because I like that bit about the iceberg melting in the warm water, which will set up the interview for the bottom of the hour. But now we're joined in the studio by Forrest Hilton, who, among other things, teaches at NYU and is the author of two books on Latin America from Verso, Evil Hour in Colombia, and Revolutionary Horizons, Past and Present in Bolivian Politics, that co-authored with Sinclair Thompson. Welcome to Behind the News.
Good to be here, Doug.
And I understand your son was a big hit out in the lobby there.
Talking politics. He wants to be next borough president, succeed Marty Markowitz.
Well, I don't know if there's an age limit on that, but we could use some new faces in New York City politics for sure. First of all, did Latin America join in the worldwide celebration of the Obama victory last week?
Pretty largely, yes. Particularly top leaders were, you know, excited. Venezuela's Hugo Chavez and Bolivia's Evo Morales were both very positive about the possibility of reestablishing diplomatic relations with the United States now that a new administration is coming in. And leaders across the board sent their congratulations, even Colombia's right-wing President Álvaro Uribe. Doesn't like Obama very much, but has to deal with him now. So for the most part, it was celebrated. There were some people who said, yes, he's an African-American, but let's not forget the second part, which is American, meaning imperialism, meaning the president of the United States, whether he's black or white, is likely to continue imperial policies towards Latin America, because those are basically the only policies the U.S. has had towards Latin America. So there's a degree of skepticism. A very healthy degree of skepticism, which probably couldn't hurt us here. But there's also a lot of tempered optimism as well.
And, of course, I don't often find myself quoting the Spartacist League, but they did describe the presidency as the chief executive of the world bourgeoisie, which is the office that Obama is stepping into, and the office generally is larger than the person occupying it, we should always remember. And you mentioned Uribe, and when we were talking the other day, you said he was looking a little like John McCain. What do you mean by that?
He's having his McCain moment in terms of economic priorities being chief, paramount, above all. Colombia liberalized its economy in line with the Washington consensus, privatized its economy in line with IMF, World Bank, and Treasury, U.S. Department of Treasury diktat. And therefore, it's very vulnerable to the financial crisis that's taking place now in the United States. And its economy has already been really hard hit by this crisis. And as everybody shifts their attention to the economy, Uribe's supposed achievements on the national security front have really faded into the background, and he's enmeshed in a whole series of scandals related to the fact that the army was running some kind of racket whereby they were disappearing street people, killing them, and then dressing them up as guerrillas in order to prove how effective they were being in combat. So as this scandal mounts on the military side and the economic crisis deepens, all of a sudden Uribe's vaunted popularity and seeming omnipresence and the kind of seemingly solid coalition around him, all of that's breaking down. So
you mentioned the financial crisis. I wanted to get to that later, but since you just mentioned it, let's do it now. How is that affecting Latin America so far?
Well, you know, I think it may be too early to tell. I mean, there are clear signs of slowdown in Latin America. The growth in Latin America, you know, never mind redistribution, but just basic macroeconomic growth in Latin America since 2000, 2001 hasn't been bad. It's been pretty decent, and it appears to be slowing in line with the rest of the world. And some countries are more exposed than others. You know, Colombia is probably going to be harder hit than a lot of countries, but there's no question that it's affecting the region as a whole. But what's interesting about Latin America in this respect is that that's the area of the world where new forms of multipolar diplomacy have been kind of hammered out in the past year. So there are kind of structures in place within the region now to try to deal with this crisis. Not in the way they did back in the 30s, whereby each individual country kind of tried to develop its own industrial base and finance its own industrialization. Right now, there's a lot more regional integration so that there could be something like a South American common market. They're trying to set up financial institutions so that they can lend to each other.
Are these structures largely independent of the U.S.?
These structures are completely independent of the United States, and they have so far resolved two major diplomatic crises in the hemisphere in less than 1 year. The first was March 1st when Colombia bombed Ecuadorian territory, and that was unanimously rejected by the countries in UNASUR, the Union of South American Republics. And the second crisis was the paramilitary massacre of peasants by the right-wing opposition in Bolivia, which was also roundly condemned by every country in the region. So those are two diplomatic crises that UNASUR has sorted out on its own. Banco del Sur is the financial aspect or arm of UNASUR, and Banco del Sur is in the process of setting up banking and credit institutions that would allow Latin American countries to lend and borrow from one another from a common fund. So this is all taking place entirely outside the sphere of U.S. influence. Russia has had a piece of it. China has had a piece of it. But the U.S. so far has been cut out of the loop completely.
And I'm wondering what the decline in oil prices from $145 a barrel last July to I think it broke under $60 on Wednesday. What's this doing to Venezuela's ambitions domestically and internationally?
Well, it seems inevitable that with the drop in hydrocarbons prices, the same goes for Bolivia with its dependence on the exports of gas to Argentina and Brazil. As the fall in hydrocarbon prices sets in, presumably they're going to have less revenue to redistribute, and there may be some very hard choices about what kinds of development programs they're going to be able to fund and what programs they're not. That said, as far as I'm aware, we haven't seen any cuts in social programs in Venezuela or Bolivia that have been justified on the basis of falling prices. So basically, I think the fallout from that is something we'll see more clearly in 2009.
I'm speaking with Forrest Hilton, who teaches Latin American history at NYU and is the author of two books on Latin America, From Versa, one on Colombia and the other on Bolivia. And let's turn to the major topic at hand, which is what an Obama administration's Latin American policy is going to look like. Well, but before we do that, what has the general drift of Bush policy been? Have they really paid much attention, or they've been too preoccupied with their Middle Eastern adventures?
They have really been asleep at the wheel with respect to Latin America. When Bush came into office, he said he was going to pay attention to Latin America. There are those who say, well, it's better that Washington doesn't pay attention to Latin America. That way Latin America can kind of put together its own development plans with respect to credit, financing, infrastructure, and so forth. But, you know, the Bush administration dumped an enormous amount of money into modernizing the Colombian army, which created a space whereby the right-wing paramilitaries took over many regions of the country. So
modernizing is one of those words I'm always suspicious of. So that just means making more an effective killing machine.
Yes, absolutely. Modernization in the sense of newer helicopters, better communications equipment, elite anti-terrorist battalions, gravy train, a huge gravy train ride for the Colombian military under President Bush. And Obama's chief advisor on Latin American affairs is a fellow named Dan Restrepo, who's a Colombian-American. He was born and raised in D.C. He's a real kind of inside-the-beltway policy wonk. Ivy League lawyer, and his father was a Colombian economist invited by JFK's wise men to help design the Alliance for Progress back in the early 60s. So Restrepo has a vision.
Now, that's not an inspiring example, right? The Alliance for Progress is a pretty dreadful thing.
The Alliance for Progress was quite dreadful because that's when they set up all these kind of really shadowy counterinsurgency networks and death squads and so forth to eliminate communism in Latin America. That's the downside of it. Now, Bush also had extensive counterinsurgency programs in place for Colombia in particular, and that began under President Clinton. So yes, the Kennedy administration sets the sinister precedent of counterinsurgency as the focus of U.S. policy towards Latin America, but it also contained the Alliance for Progress and what was called Civic Action, which was the social investment side of the equation. And Restrepo's father, like Restrepo, is somebody who believes much more in the social investment and civic action and much less in the military and counterinsurgency side. And Restrepo will be pushing to reduce the amount of money that Colombia is receiving in military aid and increase the amount that it's receiving in terms of social aid.
How do we know what this guy thinks?
Well, he's comes out of the Center for American Progress, which is where a number of mid to upper level cadre of the Democratic Party for this incoming administration are being recruited.
It aims to be to Obama what the Heritage Foundation was to Ronald Reagan, right?
Exactly. And I think that's why they set it up in the first place. And he was head of the Americas Project at the Center for American Progress. And he's written a number of position papers. He's given a number of speeches that you can see on YouTube. So the range of his positions are very clear. And he is, I think it's safe to say, a very pragmatic, flexible, liberal politician who thinks that Washington needs to get its policy in line with the new realities in Latin America and needs to stop hyping bogus threats. Restrepo does not see any threat coming from Hugo Chavez. The only threat that he sees is that the United States is losing revenue that it could otherwise be gaining through all sorts of business deals if it was willing to have good relations with Chavez. So he thinks the United States needs to get in on the kinds of development that are taking place in Latin America and really downplay the imperial pretensions and the bellicose rhetoric. So that would be a remarkable change from George Bush's policy, and frankly, it'd be a remarkable change from Bill Clinton's policy.
Any signs on Cuba?
Restrepo's position on Cuba is that it's up to the new regime of Raúl Castro to make overtures to the United States government, demonstrating its willingness to, you know, sit down and discuss what a new U.S.-Cuba policy would look like. And as far as I'm aware, the Cuban regime has already demonstrated that willingness and has already said publicly that they would very much like to negotiate a way out of this horrendous embargo with the incoming administration. So also another thing about Restrepo that's important is that he was the Democratic Party lawyer for the recount in the Florida vote in 2000. And he is a specialist in immigration issues. And I think that he probably was instrumental in helping to deliver the vote, the Hispanic vote in general. But Obama won in South Florida 53 to 47, I think, or 52 to 48.
So the Cuban dinosaurs are losing their influence.
The old Cubans still vote Republican, but the young Cubans vote Democrat. And with the exception of the right-wing Venezuelans, the rest of Latinos in South Florida voted for Obama. So this is a huge kind of sea change. And one of the things that Restrepo has said is that in order to deal with our immigration problem, we have to deal with the economic policies in Latin America that force people out of the countryside in such massive numbers and brought them to the United States. So he sees this kind of independent development taking place in Latin America as a good sign because it could lessen inequality, which is worse in Latin America than any other part of the world, and it could obviously alleviate poverty as in fact has done in Venezuela and Brazil to some degree. So he sees these as good things and positive developments rather than a threat to U.S. corporate interests.
I was reading a paper he had in the Center for American Progress website earlier today, which he seemed to say that the Washington consensus, the neoliberal package, not working too well.
Yeah. As far as he's concerned, it's over and there's no going back to it. So assuming he gets the Undersecretary of State for Hemispheric Affairs position, because I haven't seen anybody else from the Obama team who's been kind of out front on any of these hemispheric affairs, we can expect an acknowledgement of reality, a kind of return to realism. And I think this is interesting because I think we'll see it in other aspects of Obama's foreign policy. Restrepo will say, look, the Washington consensus failed on its own terms. It impoverished hundreds of millions of people, and it led to the worst inequality in Latin America's history. So the new paradigm is going to have to be different, and there's going to have to be some focus on the development of people's material well-being as opposed to just belt tightening, which is what they received from the U.S. Treasury, IMF, World Bank for 30 years.
Is there a way in which, you know, Hugo Chavez's 21st century socialism could reach some kind of workable understanding with Obama's changiness, this vague changiness? Is there a way that these interests could be reconciled, the U.S. with very longstanding ideas about the way Latin America should be run, and Chavez, who has some very revolutionary ideas about how to run an economy and how to run the hemisphere and its relations with the United States? Can they reach a deal? Is that possible?
I think it would be very easy to reach a deal. I think Chavez is very eager to have good relations with the United States government. He's not going to adopt servile postures in order to do that. That's the only thing. And at least according to his policy papers, Restrepo is aware that repairing with relations with Venezuela would not be very difficult at all. It would just involve putting aside the kind of bellicose imperial rhetoric and adopting a more flexible, pragmatic approach, kind of nuts and bolts. How is this going to work? But it's interesting because what's called socialism in the 21st century is actually a new form of national capitalism. Evo Morales and Hugo Chavez are very much hoping to broaden the internal market and strengthen national enterprises and the role of the state in the economy. And this is true for Ecuador as well.
It's rather Keynesian in a lot of
ways. Yes, you could say that.
And of course, Keynes coming back into the fashion in the United States, we could all have this sort of hemispheric Keynesianism, couldn't we?
Right. The Wall Street Journal said we're all Keynesians now, picking up on something Richard Nixon said a very long time ago when that was actually true. And it looks like we could be headed back in that direction to some degree here. Latin America, in fact, has been moving in that direction really for about the past 10 years. And what's called socialism in the 21st century is really a form of Keynesianism in the 21st century. And what's really remarkable about it is that it's anti-imperial and that it's been able to count on investment from rising powers like Russia, which, of course, has been flush with oil profits, and China. So part of the emergence of this Keynesian national capitalist model in Latin America has had to do with access to other regions that have capital investment and lessening its dependence on the United States. And Restrepo is aware of this reality, and he thinks that the United States needs to get back in the game of cutting business deals before it loses any more influence than it did, than it already has.
Oh, we've only got a minute or so left, but what you're describing sounds like it would drive the American right crazy. Do they care enough? Do they have enough influence, or do you think they could get their way?
Well, this is the interesting thing because at least in terms of Latin America, you know, the right-wing Cubans have had such a preponderant influence on the making of Latin American policy in general, and their day has really come and gone. So the future of kind of Latino affairs in the United States, I think, could be very different from what it has been in the past. So we can expect changes there, and the right is less entrenched domestically in Latin America, and the right-wing interests in the United States linked to Latin America are much less entrenched than, say, in Central Asia or Mesopotamia. So my sense is that the right wing in this country is going to have its hands full trying to defend the cause in Iraq, defend the cause in Afghanistan, and blame the economic crisis on immigrants. I don't think there's going to be a lot of space in the new right-wing imaginary to devote to Latin America.
And we've been speaking mainly about a couple of hotspots in Latin America, but what about other places like Mexico? What do you think Obama's relations with our southern neighbor might look like?
Well, that's a very interesting question because Felipe Calderon basically stole the elections with the help of his ruling institutional party, Revolutionary Institutional Party. And Mexico is the next country to receive a major package of so-called military aid, $500 million. It's called Plan Mérida, and it's really it's a copy to some degree of Plan Colombia, whereby the war on drugs is militarized and taken largely out of the hands of the police and put in the hands of the army. So Mexico is likely to become the next sinkhole following Colombia down which American taxpayer money is poured. The ostensible threat is narco trafficking because most Colombian cocaine comes through Mexico. I believe 90% of Colombian cocaine comes through Mexico, and 90% of the cocaine we consume in the U.S. is Colombian. So I think we really will have to watch Mexico and Colombia very closely and see if there are any shifts there.
So the first clue will be to see if Restrepo gets the job as Undersecretary of State for Hemispheric Affairs, we call it?
Yeah, that's right.
Because it's our hemisphere, right?
That's right. But I've seen him speaking on Spanish language television, and he does not speak with an imperial accent because he knows his audience.
All right. Well, this is one of the more hopeful things I've heard about the incoming administration. Thanks for joining us, Forrest Hilton. I've been speaking with Forrest Hilton, who teaches Latin American history at NYU and is the author of two books from Verso, Evil Hour in Colombia and Revolutionary Horizons, Past and Present in Bolivian Politics. That one written with Sinclair Thompson. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Kate Gordon. And that's some of the Who's hymn to internally combusted environmental irresponsibility, going mobile from way back when. And now we're joined on the line by Kate Gordon, co-director of the Apollo Alliance, a San Francisco-based group. Well, we'll let her describe exactly who the Apollo Alliance consists of. Welcome, Kate.
Hi, Doug. Thanks.
So who are the Apollo Alliance exactly?
Well, we are we're actually a national organization. It's an alliance of labor, business, environment, and community-based organizations with the overarching goal of getting to clean energy and good jobs at the same time. We've been arguing for about 5 years that we need to frame this environmental argument as an economic argument and really move forward with a economic recovery plan that's about the new energy economy. And we're very excited that that idea has gained so much traction.
And Apollo, based on the moonshot ambitions from way back when?
Exactly. It's the theory, you know, Kennedy said, let's get to the moon in 10 years. Everyone thought he was crazy. He did it in 8. With a huge federal investment, in today's dollars, it would be about $70 billion a year of federal investment. Goal to get someone to the moon, but it was also a goal of American competitiveness. It was a goal of job creation. It was a goal of, you know, improving our infrastructure, and all those things happened. And I think that we took that on and basically said, look, if we made a similar commitment, we argued for $50 billion a year for 10 years into our clean energy economy, we too could reach those huge, fantastic heights that no one thinks are possible right now.
And, of course, the space program had all those civilian spinoffs like computers and Tang.
It did, and lots of jobs for U.S. companies. So a lot of people forget about that, but Boeing actually built most of the components for the shuttle.
So the environment is usually presented as something in opposition to the economy. You know, we have to put off these concerns, especially hearing this during the financial crisis. We can't worry about climate change because we have to grow. Although I was amused to see Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty saying to the Republican Governors Association that drill, baby, drill is not an energy policy. So maybe they're waking up on that side of the spectrum.
Exactly.
But obviously, in your mind, these things are not opposed at all, are they?
Not at all. I mean, there's no question that we have a couple crises we're facing here, and this financial crisis has been coming. Those of us who have been paying attention have seen income inequality, wage stagnation. Those things have been rising for years. We've seen this coming. We have a crisis of the economy. We have a crisis of global warming. We have a crisis of energy dependence, and all of those things, I think it's possible to move toward climate stability, economic prosperity, energy security, but you need to make the investments. We really need as a country to step up and say, look, we need to reinvest in our infrastructure and do it in a more efficient way. We need to invest in our power grid because it's falling apart. We lose something like $20 billion a year from our power grid inefficiencies. We need to invest in our workforce. Our education system and our workforce programs have been, you know, underfunded for years. We need to reinvest in those things. That is part of an energy strategy. That is a way to move us toward a new energy economy, which has huge implications for job creation and for energy savings and for carbon reduction, but also for our competitiveness in the global economy.
Well, let's talk about this specific matter at hand. There's a lot of conversation now about a possible bailout of the U.S. auto industry, and it looks like it really needs one. Mm-hmm. We're talking $25 or maybe even $50 billion. Stephanopoulos said the other day that Obama's people are talking about $50, which is twice the number that's been circulating.
Mm-hmm.
There's also some talk that they would do it with a lot of strings attached, forcing Detroit to come up with clean and green machines.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thinking on this? Is this likely to happen, and what might it look like?
Well, I think that it's part of a bigger set of things that needs to happen. And just to put that in context, we just put out a big report a couple months ago called the New Apollo Program. It's basically our big federal investment agenda, and it includes a whole section on Make It in America, which really is investments in the auto industry and in manufacturing generally, to bring both the final component and assembly folks, but also the component manufacturers up to good efficiency standards. The 35 mile per gallon standard is a onerous for a lot of these Detroit automakers, and they accepted it and they worked for it, but now they really need their factories to come into line with it. It's going to take a lot of new machines and a lot of new training. So I do think that we really need to make those investments in the manufacturing infrastructure in order to get it up to what we need to see in terms of efficiency standards. We also need, you know, other parts of that plan, the new Apollo program, we need to rebuild American infrastructure, our buildings specifically, our buildings, our grid, our transit transportation systems. But there's a real need for huge investments in energy efficiency and manufacturing. And if you look a little beyond our immediate needs in research, development, and deployment of new technologies. So those three things need to be the cornerstone of whatever we do as a stimulus package and whatever we do for a longer-term energy strategy. And then finally, clearly we need to invest in the workforce side too. Apollo tends to argue that the workforce is a part of our infrastructure. So I think that the auto industry bill that you just mentioned really fits into that. Apollo supported Debbie Stabenow, Senator Stabenow's proposal on the $25 billion in loans for the auto industry to meet efficiency standards. We have supported the stimulus, including something similar for clean energy manufacturers. We really think that the manufacturing sector in general is a vital part of the economy. We need to diversify the economy so everyone isn't in the financial sector and supporting industries. We need to be making stuff again, and the stuff we make should be efficient.
Well, I'm speaking to you from Wall Street, where those are, I imagine, fighting words, but
yeah.
still. I do wonder, though, I mean, looking at something like the American car industry, I want to talk about the rest of your program in a moment, but
Absolutely.
Looking at the American car industry, it looks to be a total wreck. And you have to wonder if $25 or even $50 billion is enough to turn it around, or are these guys just so far gone, it's just hopeless? I mean, but well,
UAW is part of our alliance, so I can't say that.
No. Well, I want you to encourage me because there's a report that came out a week or two ago from, was it the Center for Automotive Research, which cleverly spells CAR, that said that if we lost the domestic auto sector, it would take some 3 million jobs with it. That's a very, very serious blow if it were going to happen. Can they do it? Can they turn this thing around?
Yeah, it's not just – well, you know, I think so because I think, remember that it's not just those final assembly plants. You know, it's hard to convert, you can take the final assembly plants, and I think they need help converting to make more efficient vehicles. What you always hear is that it takes 3 years, right, to move from current production into some new vehicle. And I think those plants do need help because of legacy costs, because a lot of historical baggage. In making those conversions faster and being able to sell more efficient cars more quickly to be able to make up some of their lost revenue. So, yeah, I think that there's some strategic investments in those plants that are super important. But the other piece that I think people forget is that a lot of the component suppliers to those plants are also the component suppliers to other big industrial systems, including the wind, the folks making wind turbines. A lot of those same component parts are coming out of the auto suppliers. So when we do investments into that whole supply chain for autos, we're actually investing in the new energy economy, not just through efficient vehicles, but also through other alternative power generation.
Well, talk a bit about that. What do you have in mind for alternative power generation?
Well, you know, we think that there needs to be, you really need to scale up on both sides. You really need to scale up on making the renewable energy systems, whether it's wind, solar, geothermal, anaerobic digestion. We do in our plan talk about support for carbon capture and sequestration. So those systems, we clearly need to be diversifying our energy generation, and we clearly need to be moving toward a cleaner generation across the board, and especially because we keep increasing in demand as a country. We keep adding demand to the power sector. We need to be meeting that demand with cleaner sources. So that's on the demand side. We're calling for, we were very supportive of the production tax credit and investment tax credit, which gave money to those producers of alternative power. We have supported helping existing plants, like existing power generation and coal plants, become more efficient through a number of different systems. We've been very supportive of, again, these manufacturing proposals to really inject some money into our existing manufacturing economy so it can kind of convert to become a supplier to the clean energy industries, and also for workforce training in those same industries. But we've also been very supportive of efficiency stuff. I mean, you can't just look at power generation. We also have to really look at making end use more efficient. And the building sector is just enormous. If you count in the industrial building sector, it's 70% of our energy use in this country comes out of buildings. So there is just enormous lost revenue there. We're wasting a ton of money. We're wasting a ton of energy. And we're also taking money out of consumers' pockets who are paying higher bills than they need to. So Apollo has been very supportive, and we are in our plan of an energy smart fund at the federal level that really puts money back into the local and community level to do large-scale multi-building retrofit projects to really get people's homes up to a decent standard.
I'm speaking with Kate Gordon, who is the co-director of the Apollo Alliance based in San Francisco. And what exactly do you mean? What needs to be done to these buildings?
Well, you know, there's a lot of programs out there, and some of them are great at the state level that actually in New York you have NYSERDA. That's a good example. That are programs where a small amount of money, a couple cents, are collected on people's bills, and it goes into a ratepayer account, and then it gets fed back out to help people, you know, get rebates for putting solar panels on or get some efficiency upgrades. The problem with those programs is that they really are most available to people who have the knowledge and the information to go and find them, and also who can pay up front and get rebates later. Apollo, what we've really argued, and a lot of people around the country are arguing, is that you need to get that, you need to make it bigger scale. We need to be retrofitting buildings and making them, you know, 20 to 30% more efficient, which isn't that hard, even with off-the-shelf technology. We need to be doing it at scale. We need to be doing programs like the ME2 program in Milwaukee, where folks in Milwaukee are trying to put together something that private investors join with public investors and put a pool of capital behind a block-by-block retrofit program where homeowners don't pay anything up front. They get their house retrofitted, and then their electricity bills have savings. The energy savings on their bills is split between the initial investors and the homeowners. So you see the savings. You pay nothing up front. Your house gets retrofitted, and you see the savings, and the investor gets some money back. It's a decent return on investment, and it's a big-scale project. That's the kind of thing that we really think needs to happen if you're going to talk about doing this at the level that you have to have real efficiency gains
and
create real jobs.
And you also said something about the power grid. We're losing a lot of juice, aren't we?
Exactly. The power grid is the other big place. Thanks for bringing that back up. I mean, the power grid is the number I've seen is $50 billion a year, but someone just told me yesterday that it could be up to – I'm sorry, $20 billion, but it could be up to $50 billion a year that we lose from inefficiencies in the grid. It's, you know, it has to do with our just think of it like any other infrastructure project. Just like our roads are falling apart and there are sinkholes, our power grid is old and the cables are falling apart, and we need to replace them with higher efficiency cables. We need to just do general maintenance across the country on them. And then in targeted places, there's great potential in doing these smart grid projects where you do this really high-tech grid which actually speaks to appliances and turns them off or down at times of peak load on the system so that you can save the system from brownouts and blackouts. And those are really big investments up front, but they will save us an enormous amount of money over the long term.
Well, but the other, we're so used to thinking of these things as costs, but and of course they're environmental benefits. But this sort of thing you're talking about can actually generate substantial economic growth over the medium to long term, can it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a couple ways to think about it. Like if you take the energy efficiency projects, for instance, if you're able to do those at the kind of scale we're talking about, I mean, in New York City it's different because your buildings are really big, so the scale is sort of already there. But in places with a lot of single-family homes, if you're able to sort of aggregate those and do a big project where you retrofit them all at once, you get a couple of immediate benefits. You get jobs, first of all. The larger the project, the more you can attach sort of a jobs program to it, so you can have a fairly big crew of people working on the project. You might be able to link it to an apprenticeship program, train some folks in the local area on how to do those retrofits. That's a huge benefit to the local community because it creates jobs. It also, the next sort of level of economic growth it creates are you get energy savings. The folks who live in those homes, not only do the people with the jobs get paychecks, but the people living in the homes have lower bills. Both of those things put money in people's pockets that they can then spend in the local economy. So that's a benefit. And then in the longer term, yeah, you get the longer term benefit of sort of over a long term energy savings that go back into the investors' pockets, which also is an economic growth piece. So it's sort of we think that, you know, there's an immediate stimulus argument to be made here, but there's also a long term infrastructure investment argument, and it sort of works in both ways.
And figuratively speaking, since Wall Street is not really the finance place it used to be, but my neighbors down Wall Street from where I'm sitting would say the private sector can do this. We don't really need the public sector to do this. You know, we've got all these investment funds, venture capital.
Mm-hmm.
Are they up to the task, or do we really need large amounts of public funding to do this?
Well, I think we need both. I think the private sector is really important. I mean, it's interesting, and again, going back to these, I think I'm just interested in them right now, but these large-scale efficiency projects, the private sector is interested in these because the return on investment on energy efficiency is very good. You basically can do not very much on an existing building to get it like 20 or 30% more efficient, which is a pretty good savings it pays itself back in like 3 years, and then you get the return on the investment after that. It's a pretty good investment. But you're not, if you just do that using the private sector, you're not going to get, first of all, you're not going to get the program to organize those buildings into a large-scale project in the first place. That kind of organizing takes place at the local level through local government or through public-private partnerships. You're also not going to get the jobs component. I mean, we at Apollo, our mantra is clean energy, good jobs. And attaching labor standards, making sure that workers are certified, trying to attach those building projects to apprenticeship programs and other training programs, making sure there's a local hire requirement. You just don't get that with pure private sector investment. You need the public sector kind of kicker to attach the standards to and to organize the projects. And I think just to make sure that they're happening at the scale that they need to happen and that they're happening consistently. Also, we've never in this country ever totally changed our energy system or our infrastructure without massive public investment. It just doesn't happen. We didn't switch from steam to coal without massive public investment. We didn't build the highway system without massive public investment. It's what you need to do to be able to create the systems that can move the private goods, because there's no incentive for the private sector to create those massive systems. There's every incentive to use them once they exist.
And then what you're talking about, how much of this is doable with existing technology, and how much requires the invention of new things? I mean, we have to do a lot of R&D to get to this world you're talking about, or can we do it with what we have already?
I think it's both. Again, we can do a fair amount with what we have already. We can do we could do a lot. Again, building efficiency is such low hanging fruit. We can do an enormous amount with off the shelf technology. I mean, half of these things are putting in new insulation and new glass in the windows, kind of thing. Putting in thermostat controls, things that seem really easy and are, but aren't happening at scale. Getting our clean energy, getting the clean energy sector to produce more of our power, that's doable right now, but it's going to take some, it's going to take some public investment to really jumpstart, I think, to get the private capital going. We see that with the production tax credit, for instance, for big wind and solar. If you look at the projects, the wind and solar projects in this country on a line graph, they just spike every time the production tax credit is passed, and then they go back down every time it's about to expire. So it's clearly related. So I think that it's sort of both. But in the longer term, you know, we always need to be looking ahead. We can get 20% efficiency now, but we should be looking at technologies that get us to 50% efficiency. We can, as I said earlier, we can fix the power grid now, but we should be thinking about smart grids. We can do cars that reach 35 miles per gallon now, but we should be thinking about electric cars. There's a lot of potential, and there's a lot, and that's another place where the public sector plays a role. You know, historically, when we invest in public sector dollars into research and development, it spurs the private sector to invest as well. And clean energy has actually lost investment. We've cut the federal investment in clean energy in half since the late 70s. We need to bring it back up again. Whereas the pharmaceutical industry has had a huge increase in federal investment, and there's actually evidence to show that every dollar of investment from the public sector in the pharmaceuticals gets 11 times investment from the private side because of the faith shown in it by the public side. So I do think that you need to look at what we can do now, we need to do it to scale, and then you need to look at what we can do next, and we need to make sure that we're sending the right message from the public sector.
And finally, the Obama administration has been saying some good things along these lines, although the numbers they've been attaching to some of their sentiments are perhaps not as large as they should be. What do you see coming starting in 2009?
Well, I think it's exciting to have a president-elect who even has numbers as big as he does. Obama's energy plan is $150 billion over 10 years. It's $15 billion a year. Pretty big numbers for a potential president-elect. We haven't seen those in the past, so that's exciting. I think that if you look at his plan, he's consistently been in favor of job standards and consistently been in favor of worker training and investing in workforce development, and that's very exciting. I think we need to keep the pressure on. I mean, I think that we all, as advocates and progressives, need to make sure that we're consistently reminding him and the administration to think big. I think there'll be a lot of pressure put on the administration to not spend any money because of the financial crisis, and we needed to spend money. We just spent $700 billion. We need to be spending money on these long, not just on bailouts, but on these long-term investment strategies, and particularly in the energy industry, which is, you know, got the potential for huge economic growth and also huge economic savings for the country. And that's really what we've been arguing for, and we're excited that Obama seems to have really picked up on that.
All right. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Kate Gordon, who is the co-director of the Apollo Alliance based in San Francisco. And they have a lot of stuff on their website. You can check out their new Apollo program at apolloalliance.org. apolloalliance.org. All right. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks so much, Doug.
And have a good weekend. And let's go out with this from MIA, Maya Arul Plagasam, I think. My facility with South Asian languages is not what it should be, but I think that's how she pronounces it. I noticed when the Smoking Gun published her concert writer the other day that she likes cave-aged Gruyere provided when she does her shows. And I had to say, she not only does good music and has good politics, but she's also got good taste in cheese. Refreshing and admirable to hear. So let's go out with this $20, which is the price of an AK-47 in Africa. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. Till then, bye.
Where is my mind? Play, now I give it all it takes. Like people on the internet, a new life for the intellect. People judge me so hard, cause I don't floss my teeth. I was born.